like to focus on the subsidy structure, the federal subsidy system, and how that affects public health outcomes and nutrition outcomes. In 1990, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention estimated that in the majority of the states, the obesity prevalence was between 15 and 20%. By 2006, the adult obesity prevalence in the majority of states in the U.S. was between 20 and 30%. In two states, Mississippi and West Virginia, the prevalence is at least 30%. When we look at overweight and obesity in U.S. adults, at least two-thirds of adults are overweight or obese. And there are differences across race and gender, but we can see that, in general, the majority of Americans are affected. When we look at children, who are overweight and at risk for overweight, at least 20 to 30% of children are at risk of overweight or overweight. And you can see here that there are significant disparities. Non-Hispanic black girls and Mexican-American boys, the prevalence is greater than 40%. I think we're all aware of diseases that are associated with overweight and obesity, including hypertension, dyslipidemia, diabetes, ischemic heart disease, stroke, gallbladder disease, arthritis, respiratory disorders such as sleep apnea and asthma, and certain forms of malignancy, particularly uterine cancer, colon cancer, and breast cancer. And then, of course, overweight and obesity are associated with significant economic costs. The CDC estimates that over $100 billion are attributable to direct and indirect costs associated with obesity. If we add heart disease, cancer, stroke, and diabetes, that number is five times that. And right now, three-quarters of the $1.9 trillion spent on health care in the United States is spent on people with chronic diseases. Globally, this is an issue as well. The WHO estimates that about 1 billion people are considered overweight worldwide. That matches the number who are underweight for the first time in history. And if we look at the number of deaths, in 2005, 35 of the 58 million deaths were attributable to chronic diseases. And outside the United States, these deaths are not occurring in older individuals. They're occurring in the working age population. So that number tops the number of deaths that are attributable to injuries and to communicable diseases combined. In 2000, as you all well know, the Secretary of Health in the Department of Health and Human Services released the Healthy People 2010 Objectives, which included aims to reduce the proportion of children and adolescents who are overweight or obese, and to reduce the proportion of adults who are obese. You can see here that in by 2000, the prevalence of overweight or obesity in children and adolescents was about 11%. The aim was to have that prevalence at or below 5% by 2010. Obese adults made up a prevalence of 23% with an aim to have that number at or below 15%. And just referring to the slides that I mentioned earlier, we're obviously going in the wrong direction. There's been a bit of debate about, and it continues, I think, about what is fueling the obesity epidemic here and globally. And there's a study that actually came out last year that I think is illustrative. This is a 25-year multi-ethnic cohort that came out of Hawaii looking at the macronutrient determinants of overweight and obesity in men and women, and then also different food determinants. And here you can see, I won't go through this in detail, but you can see here that total energy, fat intake, protein intake were all significantly and positively associated with overweight and obesity in men and women. Carbohydrate intake was significantly and positively associated with overweight and obesity in women, but not significantly in men. And dietary fiber, as you might suspect, was inversely and significantly associated with overweight and obesity. Again, inversely associated. And then when the authors looked at food determinants, they found that beef and pork, processed meat, and poultry were all significantly and positively associated with overweight and obesity in men and women. Fish, significantly so in women, not significantly so in men. And vegetables and fruits were somewhat protective, although not significantly in men, or the fruit weren't significantly so. But I think if you look at the strengths of the association here, what really seems to matter more is not necessarily the inclusion. Of course, fruits and vegetables are important, but they're not going to be protective in and of themselves. It's really the high-fat, high-cholesterol products that are fueling the obesity epidemic. When we look at how this compares to the direct federal outlays for food programs, the majority of monies go toward eggs, dairy, and meat products, over $800 million. When you compare the amount that went to fresh fruits and vegetables, that's about $59 million, and then about $366 million to non-perishable plant-based items. When we look at how food production subsidies compare with the U.S. dietary guidelines, we really kind of see a perverse pyramid of sorts here. Obviously there's emphasis, and I know the U.S. dietary guidelines, there's not as much emphasis on this sort of pyramid now, but the emphasis is still on fruits, vegetables, and whole grains. When you look at federal subsidy support, the majority actually goes toward meat and dairy production, and this is primarily in the form of feed grain supports, so that basically at least three-quarters of federal subsidy support go toward feed grain, meat and dairy production, and less than 1% goes toward fruit and vegetable production. And the majority of that, if not all of it, goes towards apples. So where's the money going? Well, if you look at the numbers, Tyson Foods, Smithfield Foods, Goldkist, Pilgrim's Pride, ConAgra, all saved between more than $2 billion between 1997 and 2005 based on federal subsidies to support feed grain production. When you look at the consumer dollar, less than 20% actually ends up going to the farm sector. The majority of it goes to the non-farm sector, which is basically marketing, advertising, packaging, and so forth. So I think we're faced with the question of why this is happening. Why is there such a malalignment of public health policy and agricultural policy? Well, part of it comes in the form of USDA legal obligations. Specifically, as it pertains to the school lunch programs, the secretary is mandated to give special emphasis to high-protein foods, meat and meat alternates, which may include domestic seafood commodities in their products. When we look at the commodity benefits program, by law, the Secretary of Agriculture shall use the programs only to encourage exportation, encourage the domestic consumption of such commodities or products by diverting them, including among low-income groups, and reestablish farmers' purchasing power. So what does this mean in real terms? What happens is that the federal subsidies really end up creating surplus, and that surplus is actually dumped into federal nutrition assistance programs. Federal nutrition assistance programs are great, but we want the foods to be healthful. So the foods, high-fat, high-cholesterol products, end up in the National School Lunch Program, in WIC program, in Indian reservations, and elsewhere. They also end up in the public food supply. So this kind of starts to get at the question of why a Big Mac, for example, is cheaper than a salad. And Drewnowski and others have actually written a bit about the inverse. We know that there's an inverse association between energy density and daily diet costs. So that as energy density actually goes up, there's an association with lower diet cost. And if we start to think about, well, you know, that's an association, but what about cause and effect? Poland actually provides a fairly good example of what can happen when subsidies are withdrawn. In 1989 in Poland, food subsidies were abolished by 1994, the availability of animal fats went down by about 23%, and the availability of vegetable fats went up by about 48%. Before that time, a ban on fruit imports was actually lifted as well, and so fruit imports actually increased. And between 1991 and 1994, there was a 20% decrease in heart disease and associated mortality, and a 10% decrease in stroke mortality. Obviously, this equated to tremendous cost savings as well. So when we start to think about how we might align agricultural policy with public health priorities, well, believe it or not, the American Medical Association has started to lead the way a bit. And specifically, in June of 2007, the AMA passed a resolution through the House of Delegates that established that our AMA support efforts, one, to reduce health disparities by basing food assistance programs on the health needs of their constituents, two, to provide vegetables, fruits, legumes, whole grains, vegetarian foods, and healthful non-dairy beverages in school lunches and food assistance programs, and three, to ensure that federal subsidies encourage the consumption of products low in fat and cholesterol. This really aligns with the President's Cancer Panel and others who have come out really acknowledging the importance of federal agricultural policy in determining health outcomes. So where might opportunities for improvement lie? Well, I would suggest that we need to base agricultural commodity purchases on health considerations and to eliminate or reduce subsidies that fuel products high in fat and cholesterol. And then finally, to support the availability of healthful foods in food nutrition assistance programs. Thank you so much.